You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, all of my kindreds out there. How are you guys? How's everyone doing? It's a little bit light rain here in LA, I'm told. We are supposed to have a torrential storm. But before I go on and get into the show today, we have a great guest. Before I go on, I have got to say Miss Halle Berry shut, in my opinion, she shut the Oscars down. She showed class, style. She shut the menopausal, the I can't keep a man, the whatever rumors out there of following her. She shut the whole thing down. She was so beautiful, and I love her. Love her hair shorter. I think it brings out more of her face and more of the structure of her face, and her body is just fits her so well. So shout out to Miss Berry. She was very Berry at the Oscars. Before we go on, and she was wearing, by the way, a design by Kristen Siriano. So they both worked that presentation. Before we go on, let me announce our sponsor, certified senior real estate and probate specialist, Kevin Pike of Coldwell Banker. If you're going to reach out to him in his little nice little face, 818-571-1508 again. Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, senior real estate and probate specialist, 818-571-1508. So, how many of you out there remember this handsome, dashing actor, producer, director? I believe Judy Blume's Forever. He did that. That's what kind of put him on the scene. He's done some other thing, but you would know him best, I believe. He played the character Almanzo on Little House on the Prairie. Let's welcome Dean Butler. Yay. Hey, Dean.
Hey,
look
how
at
are
that
you?
Smile. You're still dashing. You know, I don't want to get you too flustered. I want.
Well, yeah, 68 now. You know, I started at 23, Osiris, and here I am at 68, and you know, the world rolls on.
And you look dead. You still look very handsome. I'm telling you now, so nobody else told you. I am telling you now, it's hard for me to lie. I'm very into the law of cause and effect. So I'm okay. Telling you, very, very dashing, and it is my honor to be talking to you. So you have a book out called Prairie Man. It's called Prairie Man, My Little House on the Prairie, Life and Beyond.
It's actually My Little House, Life and Beyond.
My Little House, Life and Beyond. It was hard for me not to put that prairie in there, I want you to know, but.
Sure.
What is that about? It's number one best top seller on, I believe it's USA Today. It is also number one under the television dramas on Amazon. So it's doing really well out there. But take us back a little bit into your journey. Now, you started off saying you were only 22. And I wanted to make sure I talked to you about the girl that broke your heart when you were young.
Oh, but which
Tracy.
One?
Hey,
We can talk about Tracy. Well, it was still my very dear friend. And actually, she didn't break my heart. I really discovered what it meant to love somebody through that relationship with Tracy.
Yeah.
I've read this before, Osiris, and I don't know if maybe you've seen this too, but we never forget the first people we fall in love with. I mean, those people are, and if it's real, if it's powerful, you know, we never forget those people, and they remain central in our lives. And I think Tracy and I both remain central in each other's lives for that reason. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't see Tracy regularly at all. We exchange birthday greetings, Christmas greetings. We talk a couple of times a year, but there's something about that experience for the first time of really falling in love with somebody in a very full, complete, powerful way that is, you just never forget that. And it defines how you, for me, is defined the way I look at love and what that means. And so it's very important to me. You know, that relationship is singularly important in my life.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. The fact that you are a man and you are able to express an emotional expression about your feeling and your emotion gives me hope for mankind. And I mean that mankind, you know.
Thank you for that. I grew up in as my book describes, I grew up in a very matriarchally driven family. So I was surrounded by strong, formidable women and they were formidable because they had such access to love and compassion. And I am not the most, perhaps most emotionally available man that anyone's ever met, but I certainly appreciate that quality. And I appreciate the gifts that I got from the women in my life growing up, my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, these were very important women in my life. And they really gave me that gift of respecting women, appreciating women, understanding that the power of that relationship in our families, or that presence in our family life, really, really important. Now, my father was a wonderful provider. He was a great provider. He was not emotionally available to me as his oldest child. He was perhaps more available to my brother, my younger brother, and certainly my younger sister. But as his first child, there wasn't a lot of emotional connection. I know he loved me. I know he cared about me, believed in me. But there's a difference between sort of understanding that intellectually and really feeling that. Mm-hmm. I always felt that from my mother, from my grandmother, from my aunts. Always knew that. And I think that's where I learned about what the safety of being loved.
Aww.
You know, that's where I really got that. It was certainly not from my father. I know he loved me, but it was never really safe.
And do you think, now we're going to let me get into that a little bit, because I know that I know with Judy Blooms Forever, I believe that you were with Stephanie Zimbalist. Is that where she was? And then what drove you to bring the family that you gathered in on Little House on the Prairie and starting off with those women as your vocal point, going into taking you into TV and film? What drove you to make those people your family? And did that interfere in your actual family life? I mean, television is all like 24/7. You're with these people more than your own family, your own children, your own, you know, depending on what you're doing, what kind of film, the length and time. Right. What happened? How did you mesh those two worlds and make them balance?
So Little House was a very family-oriented program, and it was a very, as television goes in its time, and maybe now as well, Michael Landon very much believed in family, and he wanted families to be able to spend time together. So we were not doing the kinds of 14, 16, 18-hour days that were so common in television in those days. We worked, you know, we were working 10 hours a day, and people got home. Michael was able to shoot the page count 6, 7, 8 pages a day in 10 hours. He made it. He was committed to that. So families, his big thing is he wanted families to be home for dinner. Now, I wasn't married in those days. So I was a young guy. I was 23 to 28 years old. I had a, you know, pretty active social life. I was out there participating in our industry. I felt like I was able to do both and function. And of course, when you're that age, you have boundless energy. So you can go round the clock as necessary. I certainly couldn't do that, those hours or I wouldn't want to do that kind of intense schedule today at this age, but I could do the Little House schedule at this age. You know, it was a very life friendly schedule. And I think anybody who worked on our program, crew, cast, would concur with that. And I think that was Michael's commitment. And so I never worked on anything else that had that kind of commitment. Mm-hmm. That was unique. And that was unique to Michael, that was important to him, and he made it happen that way.
And how, at 22, this is always interesting to me, because we, as an audience and fans, we get to watch you grow up. We get to watch you mature. We get to watch every phase of an actor's life or an entertainer or a public figure's life as you grow and progress. We grow and progress as well. So at that age, if you can take yourself back somewhat at that stage, how did you make it comfortable for yourself to still mature as a man, to still, you know, let your heart out, you know, you're out there exploring yourself, your sexuality, your masculinity and everything else that goes along with growing up, and then come back and still have the same discipline to continue acting and not get yourself into any trouble like a lot of the actors can do? What's your secret?
Well, I think it comes back to having a very strong foundation in my home life growing up. I don't know that I really fully knew who I was at 23 years old. I mean, I don't know, 23-year-old who does. I mean, I think I always felt like when you're in your own self and you're looking out around you, you always feel like everybody else has it more together than you do. I mean, you feel like you're lost and everybody else seems to be okay. I think we're all, you know, as young people, we all struggle to know who we are, what we are, how we fit into the world. But I think for me, my family life, the values that I grew up with, gave me a core set of beliefs about who I was, about how to be in the world, how to behave in the world, that was really, really helpful to me. I knew how to shake somebody's hand and start a conversation. I knew I could sit down at a table and have a meal with somebody and have decent table manners. I knew how to carry on a conversation. I knew how to meet people because I'd been raised on how to meet and engage with people. And I think that that's altered and varied through the years. Yes. It's expanded through the years. But at the core, I'm the same. I'm dealing with people the same way that I dealt with people many, many years ago. Now, I think my views about the world have about how I fit into the world have altered. I think I am far more moderate in my perspective about the world. I think the world is a far more nuanced place than what I
than it has ever been before.
As a kid.
Yeah.
I think I'm far more forgiving and accepting of the just the range of people and experience, because I have experienced more, so I understand. I am not nearly as certain about anything as I was at 23.
Really?
Look, I was Alex P. Keaton as a 23-year-old. Yeah. I was a very conservative kid. I was buttoned down shirts and ties and
really.
I was all of that. I am not nearly as buttoned up as I was. Now I'm not nearly as buttoned up as I was at 23 years old. Because I've seen more. And the world is not nearly as simple and clear as it was at 23. Now, I don't think I was accurate at 23, but I thought I knew what it was.
We all do.
It's not nearly as, that's not nearly as obvious to me now. Mm-hmm. We live in a much more complex world than I imagined it was as a young person.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So let me take you back a little. How did you meet Stephanie Zimbalist and do Forever? And what is the door that led you into, I'm going to be an actor? Because you mentioned, which I love. Thank you. I'm going to express to any of you people out there that know technology to clone about 50 of the Dean Butler types. We need them in all sizes, all colors, all ages, everything. Just spread the love. But what is the door that led you into acting in the first place with those kind of women being supportive in an emotional way?
Well, I think like so many young people, I needed to find a space where I could excel. Mm-hmm. I felt like, you know, all young people need to, we all at any age, look, we all need to find acceptance. We all need to find the place or the thing that we do that resonates for us and for others around us. I mean, I think that was really important to me, to feel accepted. You know, as a young guy, you want to do it. The first place you think you want to do that is on the athletic field. You want to do it on the basketball court. You want to do it, you know, you want to do that someplace that has currency when you're a kid. You know, the fastest runner, the best player. That's the stuff as a young guy that is the currency of acceptance. Mm-hmm. It came to me later when I followed a girl I had a crush on into a high school musical production of Once Upon a Mattress and being,
Upon a Mattress?
You know Once Upon a Mattress? Yeah, do you know Once Upon a Mattress, that show? Oh. Carol Burnett made Once Upon a Mattress a huge hit in 1959 on Broadway. It's the story of the princess and the pea, basically.
Oh, but the way it sounds, and you said Heinz, I'm like, wait a minute, that sounds like a little...
No. Once Upon a Mattress is a very fluffy, light, fun, musical theater production. It's the Princess and the Pea. I mean, Carol Burnett was the diminutive Princess Winifred the Woebegone, right?
Yeah.
And so as big and brassy as she was, she couldn't sleep on a mattress with a pea underneath it. It was too uncomfortable for her. Anyway, it's a really fun story. I had a crush on our high school actress who was playing Winifred the Woebegone.
Oh.
I followed her into that theater, and there was something wonderful about being on the stage and being in the light and feeling the energy of an audience coming at you, mm-hmm. that I never felt. There was no activity that I had been involved in as a kid that felt more, where I felt more accepted than I felt there. Not only by the people mm-hmm. I was on the stage with, mm-hmm. but by my peers who were in the audience watching. Now, look, I was just a member of the chorus. I didn't have any big part in this, but it was magical to feel that energy. There's something, anybody who's been, you know, had the audience on the other side of the footlights and felt that energy that can come out.
Yes.
It's very powerful. And in that exchange that happens between an audience and a performer, you, there's a real communication that's taking place there. And it was a very exciting communication for me. And so I knew at that moment that I wanted to pursue this. So I pursued it through the rest of high school and then went on to college and started working professionally in San Francisco, in commercials, in small parts. And that work led to the meetings with a wonderful director named John Cordy. Actually, it started with a a wonderful casting director named Mary Goldhammer. Mary Goldhammer, that's right. Who was in her early days as a casting director. She went on to cast Amadeus and Alien. And
a woman casting director.
Yeah, no, she was really a wonderful casting director.
Sounds like
and
that.
She sat with me in this meeting in my agent's office in San Francisco, Ann Brebner, who was really like the ultimate agent in San Francisco during those years, if you were pursuing this professionally. And I sat with Mary and we talked and, you know, I read for her. And she said to me at the end of it, this would be a million to one shot for you to get this, but you're perfect for this. And I'm going to push for you to get this. And in that process, it came down to mix and match meetings that always happened. And the director, John Corey, who had done the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman and Farewell to Manzanar, and he had done a documentary that won an Academy Award called Who Are the DeBolts and How Did They Get 19 Kids? He was a wonderful director. Anyway, he called me before these mixed match sessions. He said, I want you to go to San Francisco Airport and pick up Stephanie Zimbalist and drive her to these meetings. I want you to get to know her a little bit before you go on camera with her. Mm-hmm. And that was really,
that's what happened.
That was really a gift. Because I walked into those meetings and there was Jeff East, who was on the big screen playing young Superman, playing the young Christopher Reeve.
Oh, wow.
On the screen and done some other work.
Yes.
But I had spent time with Stephanie in my little yellow Volkswagen Beetle driving her from SFO.
I was just talking about a Beetle. Beetles were so cute. That was the thing to have. If you really didn't have money and you couldn't afford a full blown, if you got a Beetle, everybody thought you were so cool, because you got a Beetle. What?
Yeah, I don't know if everyone thought I was
little
so cool.
I loved
this little car. It was a yellow, it was a bright yellow.
Yes, they were yellow with the Beetle.
It was great. Anyway, I got to know Stephanie in that ride and we read well together and it worked out. And Stephanie was wonderful to work with. That whole John Cordy was a wonderful director for anyone who was doing their first big thing. He was so kind and supportive, and I really learned the process from him and working with Stephanie. She was very gracious, and a young actor named John Friedrich played my best friend in the movie. And another young actress named Beth Raines played Stephanie's best friend. Diana Scarwood was doing her first big part in this. I mean, Diana Scarwood went on to have a wonderful, she was wonderful in Mommy Dearest. After that, I mean, playing Joan Crawford's daughter.
Is she the one that played Joan Crawford's daughter, the one with the blonde hair that was?
Yeah, that's Diana Scarwood, and she was spectacular in that.
She was amazing,
and she didn't have a big part in Forever. It was a small part, but you could see she had something. She was really strong, and it was all shot in the Bay Area. In Mill Valley, it was a picture postcard. It was a beautiful little film.
Setting.
And that brought me to Los Angeles. And Stephanie introduced me to her agent, Ina Bernstein at ICM. Ina signed me. Ina told me very shortly into our relationship that I think she got a bead on me right away. She said, if you ever get a chance to work on Little House on the Prairie, you're going to do that because this is a great program. She told me she cried I'd never watched Little House. She told
on the show and never watched the show.
No. I watched it a lot.
Oh, you mean before?
But I had never watched it before I got it.
Oh, I was like, what?
Yeah, I knew who Michael Landon was. Everyone. Yeah. on the planet knew who Michael Lynch was. But I had never seen the show. You know, it was directly competing with Monday Night Football on ABC during those years on the West Coast. I wasn't going to flip out of a third quarter of a great game to watch Full House on the Prairie on Monday night. It just wasn't going to happen. So, but I knew who he was because I'd seen promos and I'd watched Bonanza. And so, and she just, Ina just assured me that Little House was a beautifully done program, you know, beautifully written, beautifully shot, directed program. And so when the opportunity came up and she just pushed for it and got me in that door, and I'm just so grateful that I was that guy, the right guy walking in that door at that time to have the opportunity to work on something as good as Little House was. It was
That leads me to into this question. So why do you think that even now, even though you try to play, I don't know why people think all these ages are old. Like old is your spirit in old. I know some old young people, I mean, actually energy-wise, feel like they like 60-something years old. And then I know people that are your age and older, and they are just as vibrant and alive, and they got energy and they got life and that. And they're hip and cool and all that. And the young folks like hanging with them. But when
I don't think that's me, Osiris. I've never been hip and cool. That is so not who I am. But
hip and cool in the way of what you know, what you can share, how you can enlighten someone as to, you know, something they might be going through. Maybe they're 22 and just got their first gig and, you know, they don't have anybody to talk
about that. I can talk about that.
Because they're isolated, but it leads me into why do you think that even after all of this time, Little House on the Prairie still kicks butt? People still talk about Little House on the Prairie. You guys are on a tour. I think you're celebrating your 50th anniversary or
interesting. Like 2024 was the actual 50th anniversary of Little House, but it's continuing on. Yeah, in 2025. But
what do you think the magic is?
I think the magic is that Little House touches sort of archetypal truth about human beings, about relationships, about family and community, and I think Little House is. It offers foundational truth about people. It gives you the opportunity to decide who you want to be. You can decide to be, you know, it gives you positivity, and it gives you people who are perhaps not the best examples of how to be, but allows you to choose that, who you want to be. And I think most people will choose goodness over not being good. And I think beyond that, Little House showed how people can gracefully overcome or choose grace as a way to overcome the enormous challenges that people face, whether you're living in, you know, whether you're living in Walnut Grove in the 1880s or whether you're living in Los Angeles in 2025, anywhere. We have choices that we can make about how we want to behave in the world, how we want to occur. And I think Little House definitionally inspires people to consider the most positive ways to live in the world. And Michael Landon had a very strong sense of what goodness looked like.
Right.
And that sense of goodness is universal, and it moves through time. You could be 100 years ago or 100 years in the future. Goodness is goodness. And we know what it is when we see it, and we know what it isn't when we see it. And I don't think, you know, frankly, Osiris, I don't think that has ever been more important than it is today.
I was just thinking the same thing. The whole family structure, the whole nurturing that a child is supposed to receive when they're growing up has just kind of moved into, I don't know what's going on now, but you know, that whole thing where there is someone there, whether whoever it is, that nurtures the child and makes sure the child is developing in all those ways that are necessary to be able to function in a real world as a full grown adult, which is what's supposed to be happening. Yeah. So in Little House on the Prairie, and talking about Michael Landon, was he coming off of Bonanza when he did Little House on the Prairie? So he was coming out of that whole thing. How did he, how was he on the set with all of you guys coming from four brothers and they're all the big, rough, tough guys and the dad, you know, and all of that to yeah. now I'm in a family unit with, you know, with Melissa Gilbert and, right. you know, and little right. Lomonzo, you know, and I think, oh, by the way, I want people to remember that Little House on the Prairie was a series of books by Laura Ingalls. Is that correct?
So Laura Ingalls Wilder wrote these books beginning in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. They have sold over 60 million copies since the 1930s. They've been translated into 40 languages. Mm. They have been a very, very successful set of books that, and I think one of the things that's unique about the books, so Osiris, is that this was one of the first sets of books written for young people from a young woman's point of view. And this was a really wow. important, this was revolutionary in its time. And at the time that the books came out in the 1930s, America was descending, really, I mean, look, we talk about, you know, the Great Depression beginning in 1929, but America really didn't descend into the depths of the Depression until well into the 1930s, when things really, really got tough. The publisher, Harper and Brothers, read the Little House books and saw something very inspiring in what was being written and thought that young people who were struggling in a very challenging time in America would appreciate reading the story of a young girl growing up in a simple family with really very little around her other than love, really love in that family mm-hmm. and support in that family. But there wasn't a lot of material success in that family. And I think that they reasoned that young people would benefit from the inspiration of seeing that they could be okay. Later, at the end of the Second World War, the United States State Department translated one of her later novels called The Long Winter, which was about a devastating winter that the family lived through when there was no food and people. Yes. They'd run out of coal and they mm-hmm. were burning hay that they were Our twisting and fired. And this was translated for the Japanese following World War II.
Wow. That's interesting.
To give them the sense that they could overcome a horrible winter of sorts that they were experiencing from their defeat in the war. That there would be another day, that it could go. Well, the Japanese fell in love with Laura Ingalls Wilder and the Little House books because of that. The Japanese have been some of the, as a culture, have been some mm-hmm. of the most ardent lovers of the Little House books mm-hmm. and the Little House series as well.
And just like you said, it's so timely now. And I believe that, you know, maybe they'll do a little bit of extra push or something. Because right now, that is so important for everyone to know. It's okay to mix and mingle the structure of a family, but once you know what the structure is, not like we don't have a structure, we're going to do all these mixing things without structure, but with structure, then you have the foundation together to move forward. But back to my question about how were all of you able to work with him? And how old was Michael Landon when he did Little House? He had to be real young, like what, in his 30s or something?
He was in his 30s. He was
he was still a fairly young man. So how was it taking him from that rough, tough, I'm a man kind of man on the prairie to Bonanza?
I'm a shoot 'em up cowboy in Bonanza to being being a poor dirt farmer.
Yes.
Little House on the Prairie.
Was it awkward at first for you? Anybody? What happened? Let me know.
I think Michael was so comfortable with.
Okay.
Michael was so comfortable with what he knew. I think he responded to the Little House material, the family aspect of Little House, because he had grown up in a highly dysfunctional family with two parents who really didn't talk to each other, didn't like each other.
That's the worst.
And he had, I'm sorry, my phone is ringing. He had a choice to make about how to deal with that. And he wanted his life to be good. He wanted to be a positive influence on people. He could have gone in a very different direction. But I think he saw Little House as a vehicle. He didn't follow the books in any way strictly. The Little House books, there were 8 Little House books that were initially published. A 9th came out after Laura's passing, called The First 4 Years. Mm-hmm. But what he loved, I think, was this environment of the family. And he saw that structure, as you talk about structure, he saw and that community of Walnut Grove as sort of a laboratory for storytelling about human behavior and human goodness. What Michael wanted, I think what Michael hoped about the episodes that he did, he oversaw everything. He wanted people of all ages who were watching television. This was the age where you had a television in your living room. And there were people who had multiple televisions. But, the standard at that point in America was maybe a color television set in your living room. And you watch something together, hopefully. And he wanted you to talk about it together. Little House was a show that kids, parents, grandparents could watch together and have a conversation afterwards. And I think that was so important to him. Having grown up in a family where parents didn't talk to each other, he was so committed to creating a family on television where mothers, fathers, and children talked to each other about what was important. And I think that there are millions of people around the world who've watched this program through the years. And one of the things that they consistently, and we've talked to a lot, I can't tell you that I've had interactions with millions of people through the years, but I've had interactions with many, many thousands of people through the years. And so many who really are devoted to Little House talk about it as the family that they wished they'd had. And I think that Michael viewed Little House as the family he wished he'd had as a young person. And I think that desire drove a lot of what he did with the program. And, Michael has consistently been voted as one of television's all-time great fathers. And Karen Grassley has been consistently voted as one of television's most beloved mothers. And there's a reason for that. And he crafted it that way. Mm-hmm. Melissa Gilbert looked at Karen Grassley when she first met Karen, when they first started working together, and said, Karen's the most, she said to me, and she said to all kinds, that Karen was the most beautiful woman she'd ever seen in her life. Aww. And Karen radiated this kind of earthy goodness and strength. Mm-hmm. That was so critical to the success of that family, and Michael wrote it that way, that her strength was critical to the success of that family. He understood the importance of that.
And I also want to say, wasn't it out around the same time as All in the Family and Archie Bunker? So sure. It was a good, the networks were doing a political thing between the guy that's the dick for a dad, he loves his family, but he's got real strong opinionated. The mother can't convince him, the kids, to the lovely Little House on the Prairie and their lovely integrated family. So can you see the irony in those two shows and how they were trying to pit the good family against the bad family, so to speak?
Yeah, I think, and we were always compared to the Waltons, which was set during the Depression era America in the 1930s and 40s in Charlottesville, Virginia. You know, it was those, we were the two programs, and the Waltons came on first. Little House may have been NBC's response to the Waltons. And I think both shows touched a really nice core set of family values. And there were lots of family shows, but I think the networks were in the midst of shifting what it meant to be a family at that time. It wasn't Father Knows Best anymore. It wasn't Make Room for Daddy. It wasn't that. It was what was coming out on television was a little bit edgier than that. And certainly the comedy was a little more wisecracking than it was. All in the Family was a defining comedy looking at American values. And I think it was done with, we all learned a lot about America. All in the Family.
Yes. I mean,
if that was appointment television on Saturday nights at 8, that was a big, big deal.
You gotta watch All in the Family.
Yeah.
See, right. And then what I like about some of the shows, and you can attest to this, is the writing, the writers, how they were able to follow the times, but at the same time push beyond the times so we could get a little bit of people what might be coming, you know what I mean? And that takes talent to do all of those things. You are now, and then you yourself on this book, the Prairie Man, My Little House, Life and Beyond. How did you incorporate all the experience? Now, I have yet to read. I'm sorry, I just haven't had the chance to read it. I just got everything. But
you're doing pretty well talking about it like you have read it. So good for you.
Well, that's because Harlan, your PR person, did such a good job at writing and telling me.
Yeah,
he's probably wonderful. So I had to, and then I went on Wikipedia. I did a lot of research. So I know you were born in British Columbia, and you graduated in Piedmont of the school.
Yeah, Piedmont High School. Yes.
And then you came, I guess you got in the LA, like you said, through that door. But as a screenwriter and storyteller,
I'm more of a documentarian. You know, I would never call myself a screenwriter.
In Wikipedia, then you need to change Wikipedia because it has you down as a screenwriter.
I don't know who would write that.
I don't know, but it has screenwriter.
Wikipedia, you have to watch Wikipedia. But what I do write, I write a lot of sort of documentary-esque feature packages that are sort of human interest kinds of things. I think that you sort of learn that craft as you're doing it, and you learn about how you want to tell a story, and you figure that out. And so that's been a really fun thing for me to do. And that's been really the last, I've been doing that for 25 years. Oh, seriously.
And like I said, I'm not joking. You still have that dashing presence. I mean, I could tell it was you. There was not so much change that you looked, you know, weird. Like, okay, is that the same guy or anything?
I think I still do look like me enough like me.
Dean Butler, you know.
Yeah.
But when you were writing your book, I was alluding to the fact of you writing Prairie, Prairie Man. How much of your life experiences with all of the things you went through, starting the TV and starting the entertainment industry around a young age, were you able to now look back and reflect on and bring everybody up to time? Because it says My Life and Beyond. So you've gone beyond that time. Tell us a little bit about what sparked that Interesting.
Well, I think, you know, when you look, I knew that this was a memoir. It was presented to the publisher as a memoir. So there had to be a core to it. And look, the decision to do this now was really precipitated by the fact that Little House was celebrating its 50th anniversary mm-hmm. in 2024. There are so many women in our cast had written memoirs. No men had written them. I reasoned that the 50th anniversary of the series was the opportunity to do that. And I also knew that it needed to, look, it's a book for fans of media more than anything else. I mean, there's life stuff. I talk about my family. I talk about growing up. I talk about first love. I talk about other loves in my life, you know, hopefully respectfully. And you know, I do that, but it's the core of the book is my sort of more public life. And everyone has a story to tell about that. And I thought that, you know, I needed to
expand,
give a full picture. Now, interestingly, I've just sold a second book,
really?
And, which I'm going to be starting to write. And it is called, the working title of the book is called Living the Prairie Way, which is all about, look, all of us who have written books about that are part of Little House, prairie is always in the title.
It's a key word. It's a key. We've got to use prairie.
Yeah. You got to use prairie. Everyone, so Living the Prairie, it's all about, it's really going to be all about values. More, it's less, I mean, obviously my life experience will work its way into it. There will be lots of connection to episodes of Little House and the values that those episodes taught and how those values translate to our real life, the society we live in today. Mm-hmm. I think, again, coming back to something we talked about a few minutes ago, Osiris, I mean, I think the challenges our culture faces today have never been in my lifetime, have never been as intense. Now, other people may have different takes on this, but I really feel like, you know, with so many people talking about this, we really are at a tipping point in our culture. And I feel really strongly that I want to be a voice for fundamental goodness, decency, acceptance. You know, this is really, really important. Because our world is marching on. We're not going back anywhere. We're always going forward. And we have to find a way to deal with each other as we move forward.
As we are.
In a way that's graceful and decent and kind. I mean, I just think that's really, really important. To me, that's a very important message. So that's what Living the Prairie Way is going to be all about.
I love that, though. So I would be interested. I'm going to go on ChatGPT, and I'm going to put prairie in. I'm going to put Little House on the Prairie. And you would be surprised the accuracy of what they have to say. I was shocked at what they said about me. I'm like, I'm nobody. And you're on they have this big thing to say. I'm like, wow. But it's really interesting to find out how they view authors, the people that are writers, actors, and things like that, and what ChatGPT, just so you guys, it's a lot of fun to see what they can generate about what they think about you and the ideas in general of what they say.
Well, I mean, ChatGPT just is able to look at everything that's ever been written about somebody.
Anybody.
And able to, yeah. And if something's been written about you, you can be searched on, you can ask ChatGPT to tell you, but ChatGPT is synthesizing a lot of information and weighing that information and able to look, it may not be completely accurate. I look at ChatGPT as a really nice foundation to begin exploring an idea. I would never take something that comes out of ChatGPT and say, this is it.
No.
I mean, I haven't seen that, but there's a lot of interesting synthesis that ChatGPT can do. And this is what makes it so powerful, is it's a wonderful starting point.
It's interesting. Yeah. It reminds me of, I'm a real sci-fi watcher, so you know, I watched all the Star Trek things. Remember Nomad? The one said, my name is Nomad. And they challenged the computer, said, no, I'm your creator. It's like, no, I'm the creator. It was so funny, but that's kind of what ChatGPT reminds you of. Before we go, our time is short. It's getting close for us to go, and I'd love to continue to talk to you. And I'm sorry we didn't have a little bit more time. I'm stretching it just a little bit to give you a little bit more time to talk. But I've got to give a shout out to, once again, to our wonderful sponsor who makes this all possible for us, Kevin Pike, Coldwell Banker, 1-857-11508. He's a senior real estate. Look at that cute little handsome face.
Well, thank you, Kevin Pike, for supporting the program. Yeah.
Oh, no, my gosh. Really, I'm able to bring on people like you and I say this all the time. I'm really not interested in the new Hollywood as much as I'm interested in that old Hollywood, you know, the kind you had real stories and wasn't so much the negative. You didn't really find out a lot about people until they died, and it made it interesting, like, wow. They died and then all their secrets came out. And so you had something to talk about even after they, now there's nothing to talk about. You know, just like, okay.
Because what? Everyone's spilling the tea all the time.
You know, they're unalive now. That's what the kids are saying. You're unalive now. So we have no stories anymore, but I absolutely adore Little House on the Prairie. I couldn't believe I was actually meeting you in real life, even over the face of a screen. Of a show that I grew up watching, that I watched, and I know who the people are in the show and what they did and the kind of effect it had on us and how much hope it gave for us little kids out there that didn't have much, that there were families that could still survive even though we didn't have anything. And I think that's what Little House on the Prairie did for me.
I think that you are not alone there, Osiris. I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people got that messaging from Little House. And I think it's, you've referenced it through our conversation. It's vital that people feel like they have some foundation in their life to step forward. And Little House is one of those, it is one of those special programs that offers that to people. Mm-hmm. And so all of us who were a part of it are incredibly proud of having been a part of it and grateful to have had the chance to be a part of it, because it's given us access to people and situations for so many years, because it continues to communicate what is essentially good in human beings. And it's such a gift to be a part of that.
And even more relevant people, even more relevant than ever before. We have got to go back and, I don't mind the future. I like the future, actually. But what we need to do is also hold hands and pick up some of the old as well, so that we can still have something that is familiar enough that we can see what the future actually looks like from coming from that kind of place. But before we go, I'd like to again thank our wonderful, amazing, still forever dashing Mr. Dean Butler, author, writer, and documentary maker, Prairie Man, My Little Life and Beyond. He has another book coming out. We're going to support you. Give us your social media tags so we can find out where we can find you and follow you and keep in touch.
Well, you can always follow me at Official Dean Butler, all one word, on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Okay. And that's why I have to say that there's so many imposters out there. It's amazing how many people want to pretend that there's somebody else. But that is me officially, Official Dean Butler.
Okay, we love that. Official, he's the real deal. Official, yes, no cloning, right. No faking.
No.
He's not a ChatGPT image.
I'm not. No.
He's not a 3D print.
I've seen a ChatGPT image of me, but that's
you have? Not. Have you seen the 3D print of yourself? Oh, 3D print.
It's incredible.
Anyway, that's been our show for today. Thanks, everyone out there, for watching. Please support, like, subscribe, and share. You know, I love you, my word, for liking you, because you're brave, beautiful kindreds out there. They keep pushing forward despite all of the things that we're experiencing right now in modern day times. And I love you because you watch and you listen, and we all are learning and educating ourselves all at the same time. Don't forget to smile. It works wonders. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio, for letting me do my thing and letting me shine. I'll talk to you later and see you next week. Bye-bye. Bye, Dean.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
You are listening to 15 Minutes, the show with Osiris Munir, only on LA Talk Radio.